Welcome to Motivated to Lead Podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're going to revisit a conversation that we had with Jane Detton. Jane is a world expert in the field of positive organizational scholarship, and she's going to share ideas on how small actions can create a big impact and help your team flourish. She co-founded the Center for Positive Organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan, and she has had a long career, distinguished career, and she's got some great thoughts that she's going to share with us. Looking forward to today's conversation with Jane. We're so happy to have Jane Detton joining us. And Jane, I guess, first off, can you give us just a little bit of your story, your background?
Sure. So I have, I worked as a research assistant at a research institute right after undergraduate school and got totally hooked on the research process. And that's what drew me into trying to get a PhD. Although, again, I was the first person in my family to go to college. So the whole idea of a PhD was strange kind of in my family. But I did apply to one place, Northwestern, Kellogg Graduate School of Management. That was the only place I knew of. So I applied there, was lucky enough to get in. And the rest is, for me, just it's been just this wonderful adventure into trying to understand the complexities of organizations. So organization behavior is this wonderful interdisciplinary field trying to figure out organizations. And, you know, I've learned over the 40 years now that I've been in this that organizations are pretty messed up. And so there's an infinite demand, I think, to more deeply understand organizations and particularly to help people at all ranks, not just, you know, upper echelons, to, you know, do beyond coping with the organization, to actually make it a place in which they, as human beings, can not only excel in terms of how they perform, but they actually get healthier. I care a lot about how work organizations can be vessels for human well-being or flourishing. And so the last 20 years or so, I've been involved with this effort to kind of shift the focus in management / organizational scholarship, really trying to understand what is it that about organizations that brings out the best in people. So it's really focused on moments or chapters of organizations where people are truly thriving in a holistic way. And I've been doing research on that, but probably more importantly, teaching and creating workshops around that, because people are so hungry for how to make the organizations that they're part of better. And better, not just in the sense of financial performance, but better in terms of a lot about not making them toxic and not just settling for normal, but actually trying to make them vessels for human growth and development and health and those kinds of things. So I'm still really passionate about it. I've been involved with this kind of effort for about 20 years, working with both practitioners and academics, And there's so much work to do. I'm a grandmother, and so I worry a lot about future generations. And I feel like we are way too complacent about how letting institutions, whether they're business organizations or schools or, you know, nonprofits, any of them, we are too complacent about how to tackle issues of unlocking human resourcefulness in institutions. So anyway, that tells you sure. Maybe a little bit about how I got to where I am and how sort of fired up I still am about possibilities and creating a community of practitioners and scholars who really are tackling this from a more of a positive organizations perspective.
We want to definitely dive into the some of the areas around how to flourish, and a lot of our listeners are earlier in their careers as leaders, and definitely want to talk about that. But one of the questions I want to ask you, and this is one of our questions we ask most of our leaders that come on, is if you were able, knowing what you know now, to go back and talk to a 22-year-old Jane, what would you tell her? What advice would you give her?
To pick your context wisely. I mean, just that I've just have seen people who have that society or whatever has told them they have low potential. And if they're in a context which really resources them and unleashes their potentiality, it not only changes those people in the moment, but 10 years, their whole trajectory for their life changes. So I watch students, you know, I'm teaching a business school. So I watch students overly weight things like salary or other kinds of, I would say, seductions, you know, beyond a certain level, to have them join organizations that, again, if you think about the opportunity cost to them, it's going to actually, they're going to pay a price for that for the rest of their life. Whereas I really wish they have, and what we try to give them is have a lens for how to choose a context wisely. I think we spend a lot more time helping people choose maybe a partner or something like that more than we do about how do you choose a workplace where it's going to really, even if you're only there 5 years, is going to put you on a path in terms of your own human growth and development that will, you know, again, yield much more positive results, not just for you, but actually for the people around you, the people that you run into your life. So that's what I would say. Choose your context wisely.
Great advice. We live during a unique time. I would say it's a weird time in our history. A lot of people are dealing with some things that none of us have dealt with before. And you know, part of it with work has changed. You know, most everybody I'm talking to these days is working remotely. They're working from home. How would somebody flourish during this time? What's some advice that you would give to leaders, not only for themselves, but also leading teams?
Yeah, first of all, I think everyone needs to prioritize self-care, because it's really hard. And this sort of situation is totally draining for people. Even if you are a resilient person, the weight of this over time is really substantial. And I've spent a lot of time talking, reading and doing research related to human health. And I think it's important for people to prioritize their own health in this context, so that not only for their own benefit, but for the benefit of people around them, their families and people that are working for them. So that's what I would also say. I would say, but I have maybe it's an overly simplistic, but I find it to be a pretty powerful framework for thinking about how to thrive, particularly when you're in challenging situations. And I'm a betting person, so that's, if you're a researcher, you're betting on stuff. You're betting on stuff being working. And I've become convinced, not just with my own research, but other people's research, that you can bet on three different sort of factors or conditions that unleash human thriving. One is positive emotion. So we used to think positive emotion isn't that potent a force. Turns out it is really potent a force, not just in resourcing people in the moment, but resourcing people over time. And I can give you examples of each of these things. The second is positive meaning. So it turns out how we think about ourselves and narrate who we are, that sort of positive self-meaning, how we narrate or think about the job we're in or the role we're in, and how we think about the organizations we are a part of. Those meanings are mutable. They're changeable. And actually, if you can, if you can activate more positive self, job, and organizational meaning, it produces resources that allow you to thrive more and for longer periods of time. And the final piece in what I call the flourishing triangle or the thriving triangle is positive connections. And when I talk about connections, I'm using the word connection as opposed to relationship intentionally, because I mean, I've been blown away as I've learned about how these very short-term 40-second interactions with other people that are life-giving or generative, or, you know, they're the kinds of interactions that literally light you up, those also resource us in really important ways. So again, as a leader, thinking about how do I cultivate my own thriving and how do I design contexts in which other people can thrive, I would try to lift up the conditions so that people can experience more frequently positive emotions, positive connections, and positive meaning.
So how would you, I guess, everybody's on Zoom. We're on Zoom today. And I think I heard you in one of your talks talk about being zoomed out. And I think there is that fatigue that comes with being on a screen. There isn't that personal connection that sometimes can be there. But how can people practically have those positive connections during this time?
Yeah. Well, so first of all, it's actually pretty amazing. We do get zoomed out. That's an example of our capacity just being limited. First of all, have short meetings, much shorter meetings than you think you need to have. Have frequent breaks. I mean, we just literally, our attentional capacity cannot handle the length with which people are being required to be on Zoom. But there's a couple of things I would think about. One is, what could you do before a meeting that actually is going to lift up the possibility of connection? So what is the aim, you know, rather than just sending a Zoom invite, for example, how could you send an email message with a Zoom embedded in it that actually would make people want to show up, not just for the task, but show up for each other? Mm. So maybe you could share one or two pieces of good news. Maybe you could remind people of the importance of this meeting relative to what the organization or this meeting is trying to accomplish. You know, maybe you could tell a tale of something really good that happened, you know, that the team accomplished or whatever. So the idea is we prepare for lots of things, but oftentimes we don't prepare for a meeting except for an agenda and a Zoom invite, maybe. So how could you prime the pump so that people will show up authentically and where they're looking for the best in the other? That's one thing. A second thing I would say is first moments matter. So what happens in the first minute or two of that meeting is hugely consequential in terms of the trajectory of the resources in that meeting. So the first thing that you do in terms of how you engage people is really important. So for example, you know, could you use the rename function on Zoom for people just to share one word that captures how they're feeling right now? And then you just have people, give people a minute or two for people to scan and just see like, whoa, where is everybody here now? And it's in a way, it's kind of a mindfulness. It's a mindful connection to others that, again, lifts up positive emotion. People feel oftentimes grateful. They feel a sense of connected humanity, blah, blah, blah. But what happens in those first 1 or 2 minutes is consequential in terms of how willing people are to resource the meeting with themselves. And then there's lots of things that you can do during the actual Zoom meeting, oftentimes enabled by you having some rules of engagement, particularly that invite people to participate. And I actually attended this great teaching from the Presidency Institute this summer. And one of the little rules of thumb they had when they put us on breakout groups, they said, use this little simple device. Don't have anyone talk twice until everyone's talked once. Mm. I mean, it was a really simple kind of rule, but it was sort of saying, we want to hear from everyone. So rather than just say, we want to hear from everyone, you know, give a rule that would allow a simple guideline. And there's a lot of different things that you can do, again, to invite people to connect on their own terms in these Zoom meetings. And It's just we're limited by our imagination and we're limited by our beliefs that, in fact, this doesn't matter. It's all about task, where it's not about human connection. But what if the social tissue in which that you create between each other in Zoom is actually critical for the innovativeness that you have, your ability to deal with mistakes, all these other things that are the research on psychological safety would suggest is really important for a team's functioning. So it's worth investing in that.
So you wrote a book some time ago, it was Positive Leader, Small Actions, Big Impact. Talk a little bit about that during this time. I think sometimes people have been thinking maybe 30 days is kind of as far out as they're planning as an organization. And now I think organizations are starting to figure out we've got to think longer term. But what are some small things that people can be doing that will make a big impact on their organizations?
Well, I'm just going to take some ideas from the book.
Sure.
I mean, the book is an edited book, so I like to think of it as a buffet, a really tasty buffet of tasty bits from all these wonderful researchers that are working in the field of POS. So I'm going to steal and share some of their ideas. One powerful idea is about a small action is to let people craft their work. So there's this idea of job crafting, which is basically allowing people, having people reflect on kind of how are they currently conducting their work. And the question is kind of how could they at the margin tweak it, re-engineer it from within through small moves that are actually going to make that job more engaging and more and make them more productive over time. And the research would suggest that people can do that. It's actually, again, it's partly just inviting people to consider it.
Sure.
Do it by changing the task, like a little at the margin, how they order the tasks, doing the things that they like most, either early or late, in ways that resource them to do the stuff that they like least. Changing the frequency and who they interact with at work. That's what we call relational crafting or cognitive crafting, how they change, how they think about the work. Like how would they change, for example, their role description or their job label? I'm going to give you one example. One of my favorite examples is, as you know, I studied compassion at work, and Louisville, Kentucky has a self-designated compassionate city. And they noticed that the city noticed that a lot of people were sharing troubles with the bus drivers in Louisville. And the mayor of Louisville, in conjunction with several of the public servants that were working for the city in Louisville, invited them, the people in doing this kind of work, with direct contact with the citizens, to rename their jobs in ways that had them serving the well-being of the city. And so the bus drivers were called and named a job that made that they were guardians of the city. That's what the bus drivers became, in which they participated in what had been a distraction. You know, someone comes on and says, you know, I've just been kicked out of my home, or my child is having all kinds of mental health challenges, or whatever it is that's being shared with the bus driver, rather than being a distraction and something that someone had to do, they cared to do, but it wasn't part of their job. It became a part of their job. So job crafting is one important avenue for helping people make small actions with their work in ways that makes it sustainable, so that you're not sacrificing, again, the job being done well. You're actually empowering people to think and imaginatively using a couple of core principles to redesign their job from within in ways that makes it more sustainable. Another example of a small move is Adam Grant wrote a chapter in there about, I think he called it outsourcing inspiration or outsourcing motivation. Sorry, I don't remember exactly the title. But the idea was based on his research, which would suggest we can motivate people a lot by helping them, helping connect the impact of their work to them. So that, I mean, his kind of a famous study, it was his dissertation, where fundraisers actually at U of M, you know, were making these horrible calls they have to make to try to raise money, which is a very hard thing to do because you're refused a lot. And he found that 10 minutes of interaction with a scholarship recipient, where the call givers could interact with the scholarship recipients, which is what their calling was generating, you know, impact on the scholarship recipients, that there were sustained effects 3 months later on not the number of calls that these call givers, call givers did, as well as their actual amount of money that they collected. So there's so many opportunities for people to be connected to their work. I was talking to someone this morning who was talking about she does work in hospitals, and the people who do scheduling of operations, which can be a very tedious and actually a really demanding job, but it's quite disconnected from actually the health impact on the patients. And this woman was telling about how they had made regular check-in meetings with the schedulers to give them feedback about how, you know, they're rearranging certain kinds of schedules was actually, you know, reducing, I don't know, number of times that patients had to come back, or, you know, it saved someone's life in a radical case. But there's just all kinds of ways that we could connect people more to the impact of their work. And the job crafting example, or the impact design sort of example, are both, those don't cost money. Neither one of those changes costs money. It just costs paying attention to the fact that, you know, re-engineering these local contextual conditions for people and taking their humanity and goodness seriously, because this is, you know, can actually help you unleash all kinds of resources in people and in the systems that they're part of. It's actually a bit, you know, I can tell a whole story about this that's deeply hopeful, because, you know, we do have so many resources in organizations that are unlocked. So that's kind of my happy, optimistic, you know, we, you know, look at all that we could do kind of story. But there's also a very, a story of deep urgency and, you know, boy, are we in trouble as a society. And, you know, we can't throw more money and material resources to solve this stuff. We have to be smart and imaginative about how to unleash it in human communities. So for me, it's actually, as I mentioned with my grandmother hat particularly, I mean, you have to just tone me down when I'm giving talks about this, because I get quite agitated about, why are we wasting our time on all this? We know how to do some of this. It just takes courage and and commitment to act this way. I don't get it. I don't get why this is not a dominant perspective of how to organize for human flourishing, where we could do things that we can't imagine, but which we deeply need to do as a society.
You have an entrepreneurial bent, so you understand how this actually applies in businesses. And I know when I've talked with Bob Quinn and Kim Cameron and Wayne, that they talked about sometimes people think the positive side of things is soft and it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference, but it really does. There's data to show that these organizations that are flourishing and have this as a part of them are doing much better. Talk a little bit about that, of what you've seen.
Yeah, I mean, we've been sold a bill of goods that's just wrong about human nature. I mean, the beauty of neuroscience as a whole new discipline is it's basically helped us understand how our bodies work. And the whole story about self-interest being the basis for human success is totally wrong. And so we are built to serve others. That's the way our brain functions. That's the way our body responds to how our brain functions. I mean, we can go to self-interest, especially if we're in a culture that perpetuates that myth, but we are actually born physiologically to be other-focused. And it makes sense, right? Our ability to survive as an individual or as a group depends on our ability to be generous and kind and help each other survive. But incentives and structures are in organizations have been built around the assumption that people are self-interested and that they will default to a place of self-interest over others. And it has taken us down such a path of destruction and depletion. And it's terrifying, to be honest. So I don't think being positive is easy, and it's certainly not soft. It is the only way we are going to get out of this mess we're in as a society, whether we're talking about, you know, really dramatic changes needed around human health, around climate change, around inequality, et cetera. And so, again, what terrifies me is that we're going, you know, we can have organizations that are financially successful, but they are extracting assets out of people and out of the earth in ways that my children and my grandchildren can never recover. And so I wish we didn't have to call it positive, because it does get dissed. That's why I like the language of flourishing and thriving and health, because who can disagree with that, you know? But it does require taking things that, like, I mean, positive emotion is soft. I mean, it's ideas of awe or gratitude or kindness or the, you know, those are seen as soft, yet they are enduring. They are enduring aspects of the human experience that build capacity and health and in communities that really survive over time. I mean, history tells us you can have dynasties that will, again, win in the sense of they have more territory and more wealth at a per period of time, but they're not sustainable. And we need sustainable ways to thrive as human communities in business and elsewhere, or we don't have a chance. I mean, really, we don't have a chance. And the wall is getting closer and closer in terms of whether we're going to be able to really turn this around. So I can get depressed about, you know, to the degree that this is sort of seen as soft. And the leaders that I really admire, Satya Nadella at Microsoft, for example, or Jeff Weiner, I mean, used to be the head of LinkedIn. I mean, the way they manage, the way they talk about human beings and what, you know, how human beings are so essential, and the way they give me hope, as well as, you know, not just the CEOs, but down at the level of the everyday. I mean, the everyday customer service representative who is, you know, just doing a phenomenal job responding to that customer, but also, you know, sharing information with people who need to know it about how that customer's experience needs to inform how we're delivering things. I mean, it goes all the way down the line.
So as you look at, you know, things that you've written books and a number of, I don't know how many articles, hundreds of articles over your career, and you've read other people's work. What books would you recommend a leader to read, just to learn more about some of the things that you're doing, and also as well as others that you respect?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of a rah-rah from my colleagues. I, you know, I do think Bob Quinn's books are. I love his book, "I'm Building the Bridge as You Walk on It." I love that book and his description of kind of everyday leadership. I love that. And then Kim is more sociological than Bob. He writes more about systems, and I feel like his multiple perspectives on positive leadership that sort of focused on trying to create virtuousness at the organizational level. It's Cameron and Levine, making the ordinary extraordinary. I might also recommend anything that David Cooper Ryder has written. He is the founder of Appreciative Inquiry, which is a view of change that organizational change that's based on building on the positive. And, you know, he's created the Global Compact, the United World Religions. He's used that intervention to make amazing change happen in the world. So that's anything that he's written, I would recommend. I'm currently being really transformed by reading the work of Otto Scharmer, who is at MIT. He is the author of Theory U, and he has a whole perspective on how to make change happen by unleashing the imagined future as opposed to making change happen based on the past. And I think that he, like me and others, focus a lot about how do you create a connected tissue, what he calls the social field in an organization or in a system of organization that, you know, again, calls forth human capacity building and capability building. And I just think, I think he's light years ahead. Just like when I ran into David Cooper Ryder, like maybe 30 years ago, and I thought, oh my gosh, this guy's on a totally different planet in terms of how he's thinking about it. That's the way I feel about Otto Scharmer. I think he's really extraordinary. Mm. I mean, I think what, you know, some of my former students are writing is pretty great. Like Scott Schoenstein's written a book called Stretch, which is how do you unlock resources in organizations. I mean, Adam Grant is one of my former students. I mean, he's written several books that I think, and he has a new one coming out that I'm not allowed to say the title. I would definitely watch what he's doing. You know, I just would encourage people go to the Center for Positive Organizations at Ross School of Business. There is a lot on our website that you can link to. A lot of the books that are kind of in this space, and as well as a lot of white papers and blogs and all kinds of, you know, and connections to other sites of this perspective that are blossoming kind of all over the world.
Great. Yeah, definitely. So they would go to the, so Jane, outside of writing and your work, what do you do to recharge?
I'm not a cook. I mean, I was just thinking, I walk a ton. I actually am. I'm a beach walker. I live on Lake Michigan, and Lake Glass is one of my favorite things. So I'm a mosaicist, and I make jewelry out of sea glass and those kinds of things. So, but in my semi-retired state, to be honest, I've learned a lot that, wow, I don't have a lot of hobbies. I've got a major recharge to do in terms of getting more into my life that is not the strict work, which I've been doing for 40 years. So it's a blessing that I have this chapter. And as I mentioned to you in the beginning, you know, right now, especially, I feel like I'm just trying to create openings to be of use and whatever's called. I'm doing a lot of coaching of women. In my field, young women, doctoral students, and junior women, trying to help them stay in the game and, you know, trying to do work around the racial injustice work, which I've not really been a good ally, I feel. So I have a lot, there's a lot of self-reflection going on right now about kind of what it means to be semi-retired and rewired at a time when there's so much human pain. And I do a lot of workshops on compassion in work organizations because I've written quite a bit about that with my colleague Monica Warline. So again, my job right now is just to be open and to be of use as best I can.
Great. What parting advice would you give to a leader at this time?
Keep the faith. You matter. leadership matters. Boy, does it matter. I mean, that's, and as I said before, I think the power of a leader's imagination to see that there's all kinds of resources in the system, in people that need to be unlocked. And that as a leader, through the way a person conducts themselves, through their respectfulness, their kindness, their, you know, their flexibility, those kinds of things, you can make such a difference in terms of unleashing that human capacity and capability.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.